And welcome to the weekly local news roundup here on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran. I'm the news director here at the station. We're going to discuss the top local news stories of the week, and I'll be joined by about a half dozen journalists, regional journalists, throughout the hour to talk about their work. Gwen Friss is in the studio here in Woodsole. Gwen is, of course, with the Cape Cod Times. Hello, Gwen.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. We expect to speak with Sarah Brown from the Martha's Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim Deruta from the New Bedford Standard Times, Ann Wood from the Provincetown Banner, and Nelson Siegelman from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Brian Morris from WCAI also will join us to talk about one of the stories. Let's begin with the Cape Wind Project. Of course, the Cape Wind Project is the proposal to install 130 wind turbines in the waters of Nantucket Sound. We've been talking about it for about 15 years, and sounds like some of the attorneys working on that particular project expected to get together on Thursday for a hearing about a permit, but there was a surprise.
There was. Cape Wind Associates, instead of showing up for that hearing with the state's facility siting board, called and said that that they would not be doing that. You know, so essentially, this means that on the state level, the project is, well, some people are saying another nail in the coffin, you know, dead in the water, that kind of thing. So that was a big surprise for a lot of people. And the company spokespeople were not immediately commenting on why.
So this particular permit, if you remember, goes back to 2009. It was like a super permit. They bundled all these permits together that they needed to bring the electricity ashore from the project, assuming it would one day be built. And so we've seen the project kind of disintegrate over the past few years. And so for for Cape Wind to not continue to try to keep this permit alive, it's a big message.
Right, and this is the permit that affects the transmission line. So it is a big message. But the folks, and you know, while the people who do not want the wind farm, the opponents were saying this is great news yesterday, they were also sort of mindful of how long and complicated this battle has been. So like Audra Parker was saying that The opponents are now going to be shifting their attention to federal questions involved with the Cape Wind siting, just to make sure that there aren't things going on there that they also want to speak against, you know, and stand up against. But on the state level, at least, this really seems to deliver a message.
Right, and the project would be all in federal waters. Of course, the opponents of the project, Save Our Sound, and Audra Parker is the director of that opposition group, they've been careful, as it has appeared that Cape Wind was not going to continue or be successful. Save Our Sound is kind of hedged its bets a little bit because they didn't want to lose the support of their base in case something did kind of come up again.
Exactly. And I think they're talking about that still being a possibility at the federal level.
Right. So. Well, there was some activity yesterday here in Woods Hole. I want to bring Brian Morris in. Brian Morris, of course, is the co-host of Morning Edition. He also does reporting here at WCAI. They had a piece of technology that the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution was demonstrating or showing to journalists that is also related to offshore wind. It's really kind of neat. It's called a wind cube?
It's the wind cube, yes. It's a really interesting piece of technology. It kind of looks a little bit like a portable refrigerator, like the kind you might put in a college dorm or something.
Maybe
a little bit bigger than that, and obviously a lot more high tech. And it's an instrument which essentially will take incredibly accurate wind measurements at various heights, what they call hub height, which is the height of one of the wind turbines that would be deployed in the, you know, in the areas that they're looking at.
So they're looking at putting this about 2 miles south of Martha's Vineyard.
That's right. They're going to be deploying it today. And, you know, you have we have these three companies now, Dong Energy, Deepwater Wind, and Offshore MW, who are going to, sometime within the next year or so, they're going to be vying for installation of their projects in these leased federal waters. And this instrument will give potential backers or financiers of their project a really accurate. They want to be able to show these folks, look, here's exactly what the winds are going to be doing in these waters. And so it's a way to really, with great accuracy, show potential backers and financiers, give them, they're going to, this instrument will give them a reading of about a year's worth of wind readings, showing the consistency of the winds in that area.
Which of course, there are huge swaths of ocean south of Martha's Vineyard that the federal government is managing a process to install wind turbines. There could be thousands of them at one time. Mm-hmm. This wind cube was funded with a grant from the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center.
Correct.
So they're thinking about, I assume, Massachusetts waters.
Do you mean
to install eventually? So we have the federal government doing its thing.
Right,
And now it looks like the state, which has been prompted to install, I think they're looking at 1,600 megawatts of wind that they want.
The new law that was passed requires 1,600 megawatts from wind to be procured from the power companies. So, yeah, this is a big step in that direction. And this, as I said, it just gives them, will give them much more accurate wind readings than they've had before. So it's kind of an interesting, exciting development.
Yeah, it uses lasers, this piece of
technology. Yeah, it uses actually lasers. It's kind of interesting to see this thing. It's this cube-shaped, white cube. It has an opening in the top, a circular opening with a sort of mirrored glass to protect it from sunlight. And inside that are these laser elements which shoot five lasers up in the sky in different directions and is able to take these wind readings using that laser technology. It's quite sophisticated.
So all indications are that Cape Wind will not go forward in Nantucket Sound. That's not a done deal, but that's what the indications are. But it also, we're hearing, it seems that the state really does want to install some more turbines, and they would have to be
in that direction,
closer to shore. Yes,
that's right.
Thank you, Brian Morris.
You're welcome.
Gwen Frist from the Cape Cod Times. Another story, this one involving also energy, but the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. There's a big inspection coming up for the station, which is ranked as one of the worst in the country.
That's right. It starts on November 28th, and we've spoken about this before, I know, in some of our updates, but it starts November 28th, and as it stands right now, there are 20 federal experts from around the country that are to come in and inspect the plant, partly because it's been deemed one of the three worst operating plants in the country. The other two are Arkansas 1 and Arkansas 2, and they're all owned by the company that owns Pilgrim, which Entergy. So that's what is prompting this inspection, this massive inspection. But the new news, the latest development, is that one of the watchdog people for the nuclear plants is asking that there be a 21st member appointed to that commission, and that Mary Lampert says there should be an independent expert who can come in and do the inspection. And she's asking for a few specific things for that person. And, you know, one is that there be no confidentiality agreement. And that would mean that whatever was found could be shared. So, you know, that would be a lot for the public. And she's asking that instead of doing just a general look at the plant, that this person have access to some of the problems, the reports on the problems that have arisen over the past year or two. Things like there was a finding that one of the security officers was not doing fire checks and had falsified 200 records. So she wants the independent auditor to be able to look at the problems that have already arisen.
Right. And we're speaking about Mary Lampert of Duxbury, who has been on the front lines of the battle against Pilgrim for decades, as actually pretty much a self-trained attorney who was often called upon by the NRC to testify because of her knowledge. And so it'll be interesting to see how the NRC reacts. Of course, the criticism has always been that the NRC and industry are too tight, and that they move from industry into the NRC and back and forth and back and forth. So this call for an independent inspector, I think, is a way to kind of combat that a bit.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think that the attempt to have that person be at liberty to speak about what's found is a really big part of this. And I should have said that about Mary Lampert. Sometimes when you cover people for a long time, you forget that you need the full identifier there. But she has been working on this for
seems
like forever.
The idea that these things would be kept secret is really concerning. And number one is get out there with the information, in my mind. Let the public know, because it's the public that really benefits or could be in jeopardy from a nuclear power plant.
It you know, just to say for the NRC, they're certainly they do have requirements for public reporting, but they're more limited and they come much later than, you know, the news would come if it were coming through an independent source.
And I should say that the NRC spokespeople actually have been very good over the past few years in getting right back to us anyway, and I think the Cape Cod Times.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Well. So
I didn't mean it that way. I meant, like, you know, the federal filing regulations.
So. Absolutely. Let's go to the phone, where Sarah Brown is joining us, and Sarah is with the Martha's Vineyard Gazette. Hello, Sarah.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Let's start with early voting. Early voting, that begins in just a few weeks. And how does that work on the island?
Yeah, we're about a month away from Election Day, almost exactly, which is November 8th. But yeah, like you said, voting actually starts sooner than that this year in Massachusetts with the new early voting initiative, which went into law a few years ago but now goes into effect. And basically, and the goal is to increase voter turnout and alleviate long lines and things like that. And other states do this too, so it's not just Massachusetts. But basically, voting can now begins and is open to people who want to stop by their town halls or their designated place and cast a ballot beginning October 24th and running through November 4th, so kind of those 2 weeks before Election Day. And like I said, voters can stop by designated locations on the vineyard. It's mostly town clerk's offices during set times and cast ballots. And then those ballots are sealed and counted on Election Day along with the rest of the votes. So, and like the times do vary from place to place. So voters can check with their local precinct to find out when they could go cast ballots. It does, like I said, each town is doing it a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. You know, here in Edgartown, there's actually some Saturday voting hours. So kind of some flexibility for people who maybe just want to cast their ballot early or maybe have a conflict or have to work on Election Day. And this does differ from absentee voting, where you have to have a reason that you can't actually come to the polls, so that you're not going to be there, or you have a physical disability or a religious conflict. But early voting is open to anyone. Any registered voter can stop by and vote early.
Okay. Let's talk. Let's move to another story, Raising the Goat. I read this story last night after you sent it to me, and I smiled the entire time. Tell us about Raising the Goat, who I know a lot of vineyarders have encountered.
Yeah, Raising the Goat is a pretty quintessential vineyard story. And sadly, Raisin died last week of pneumonia. He was 9 years old, so pretty old for a goat. And he lived a great life, as we wrote about this week. And he also, I should say, had a wide audience and fan base. His owner, Tom Ash, his daughter, Alexi, is married to Seth Meyers, the actor and the host of Late Night with Seth Meyers. And Seth has actually talked about Raisin twice on the David Letterman show, you know, shown pictures, told stories about Raisin. He had some, so he kind of got some national attention that way.
Mm-hmm.
And this week, I really liked Seth Meyers' quote about Raisin. He said, "Working in show business, I've had the pleasure of meeting many goats, but none stole my heart quite like Raisin." So, high praise.
That's very good. What was really nice is Raisin lived kind of a dual life.
Yeah. He had this double life in the winter when Tom Ash, and the, you know, the off season when Tom Ash was at home in New Mexico, Raisin would live at North Tabor Farm. And I think he lived with, like, two other goats, a goose and a cat. And he would live the life of a regular goat, you know, chew on grass or, you know, do goat things. And then in the summer, Tom Ash would come pick Raisin up, and by all accounts, they were really attached to each other. Raisin got really excited during the whole off season. Tom Ash would, you know, check in on Raisin, but Tom would come for him, and he would kind of begin to live this other life, his summer life, which was kind of quintessentially vineyard. He would go to the beach. He would go out in the boat. He was a fixture at the farmer's market, on the porch of the Chilmark store. I think. If you were up island in the summer, you probably encountered Raisin at some point. He was basically, he would go wherever the family went. So it was really kind of a cool summer life. And then he'd go back to his farm in the off season. And he was also a blue ribbon winner at the fair several times. I think he won oldest competitor a few times. And I actually remember meeting Raisin at the fair a few years ago. And he really was a great goat and definitely personable and and he'll be remembered. And you certainly have this really cool vineyard life.
I loved the image of him jumping into the car like a dog. I love that, and I also love the fact that Raisin could go where dogs couldn't.
When exactly. They were... yeah. There are some no dogs allowed signs at some beaches, but there I guess goats don't. That doesn't apply to goats. So
good.
Raisin
okay.
skirted that, flaunted that, and I also have to say Raisin had also really cool early on the beginning of his life. He was actually given, when he was a kid, to local chef Chris Fisher, who, as many Islanders know, is known for raising and cooking local meat. And someone got concerned about Raisin, oh, gosh, what might happen to him, and spirited him away from Chris Fisher. And that's how he ended up with the Ash family, and he became a member of the family. And like you said, hopped in the car and hopped in the boat and was part of the family.
And it's really, really good story.
I say that it's only on Martha's Vineyard that even goats have seasonal homes,
Yeah, even the goat has a seasonal home.
Yes, he did the vineyard shuffle.
Well, I could talk about Raisin all hour, but we might lose much of the audience that way. Sarah Brown of the Vineyard Gazette, thank you very much.
Thanks, Sean.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle will join us, and Gwen Friss is here from the Cape Cod Times. And welcome back to the Local News Roundup here on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me is Gwen Friss from the Cape Cod Times. On the phone is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hello, Tim.
Hi, Sean.
Tim, we've been following the story for quite some time about the Monomoy Wildlife Refuge and the push and pull between the federal government and local officials. Now it's also state officials. And, boy, this story seems to just have some real legs to it. Tell us about it.
It certainly does, and what happened this week was really the final tack in a three-prong approach that the town and the state are taking to fight the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on what they say is overextension of federal authority to the waters west of the Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge. On Tuesday, Attorney General Maura Healey announced that the state intends to file a lawsuit in U.S. District Court to confirm state ownership of that area west of the island, which is about 4,000 acres of water and submerged land. As we talked about before, the Fish and Wildlife Service recently completed a comprehensive conservation plan for the island, and they asserted ownership and regulation authority over that area, really for the first time in the refuge's 72-year history. The agency says that the original act that established the refuge gives them the authority to do that. But, of course, the town and the state disagree. They say they've managed the resources in that area, including regulating fin and shell fishing. Since the 1944 act that established the refuge, and they say that act only covered the lands above mean low water. Healey said in the lawsuit that she's seeking to restore the balance that existed since the refuge was established, before this latest plan was implemented, and she also is reaffirming the town and state's commitment to protecting valuable Cape habitats for future generations. Now, as we know, there are two other efforts underway to try to settle this dispute. Recently, Representative William Keating filed a bill in the House of Representatives to clarify the boundary to basically say that the state unequivocally has the ownership of that disputed area. And that bill is now before the House Subcommittee on Federal Lands. And the town and the Fish and Wildlife Service are also engaged in negotiating over a memorandum of agreement that would provide joint management authority over the disputed area until this ownership issue is resolved. The town has seen legal action in the past as sort of a last resort because of what they saw as an expensive and prolonged process. And they had hoped that the state would take that lead, and that's what Healey's office is doing in their announcement this week.
I found it really interesting that the wildlife, that the feds were kind of like, well, wait, why are you filing legislation? I thought we could kind of work through this issue with the courts.
Yeah, and there's a bit of a disagreement on that, and that's what they're negotiating over now in the memorandum of understanding. The town sees that as a stopgap measure, while the feds would like the memorandum of understanding to be the be-all and end-all to resolve this issue. But the town wants something more permanent than just a sort of a add on to the comprehensive plan.
Yeah, the feds they don't know Chatham very well. They should pay attention to the skydiving issue to see how that town holds on to things and fights things.
Certainly one of the traits that people have here, especially if it's something as important as fishing and shellfishing rights in an area that, you know, mm-hmm. just for centuries, local authorities have regulated.
Yeah, absolutely. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thank you very much, Tim.
Thank you, Sean. Take care.
You too. Gwen Frist of the Cape Cod Times. Let's talk about the NOAA Emergency Homeless Shelter in downtown Hyannis. It's been a topic of discussion for quite some time. It's been controversial because some people say it shouldn't be there. It's disrupting tourism. The people are just kind of hanging out all day. It's an eyesore on Main Street. Others, of course, have said this is where the services are, this is where the people are, this is where the homeless shelter should be. Now it looks like the organization that has run the shelter is stepping away and inviting Catholic Services of Fall River to come in.
It's very much of a change because it's a management change, and a lot of the questions that you just talked about, those are up in the air for now as to what's going to happen because, you know, they're just coming in, and it is the Catholic Social Services of the Fall River Diocese. They have they have experience in managing shelters for the homeless. They have facilities in both New Bedford and Fall River. And what they'll be doing is coming in and renting the building basically from the Housing Assistance Corp. And the president of the Housing Assistance Corp and also the board of directors says that this will allow that agency to spend more time and resources on, you know, placing people in their own homes and that kind of thing. So. And as you said, there was this decision came, but the day before there had been another big question raised about the NOAA shelter.
Yeah, the NOAA shelter now is what's called a dry shelter. I mean, that I think that came down because of some of the controversy about the shelter's location. Were these people on drugs? Were people drunk in the shelter? In any case, they went to a dry shelter system. So I believe that people, clients who come in are actually given breathalyzers or urine tests to see if they are indeed inebriated.
I could tell this was a story that had some traction because I was at a dinner party last night and everyone was talking about this question of whether or not, you know, shelters were generally dry shelters around the state, that kind of thing. And everyone, the first reaction was that, well, why wouldn't they be? But I was kind of surprised to read that it was only in November 2015 that NOAA became a dry shelter where people are required to prove that they're not using alcohol or drugs in order to spend the night there. There were concerns about a couple of things. One was like the state's monies and reimbursements and whether they, because they didn't recognize a dry shelter. So that was one of the concerns that the Housing Assistance Corp had. But then, of course, the very next day, we saw the transfer of management. So now it'll be a question more for the Catholic Services and whether or not they'll run it as a dry shelter. On their website, it says that their New Bedford shelter is dry, but there's also a note on there that says that people who are not visibly intoxicated will be allowed to come in, and there's arguments on both sides because, you know, you have some people who are trying to help the homeless who say that when you do that you're leaving people out on the street to freeze, you know, that you really can't discriminate against them that way. But some of the sober residents of the shelter that we talked to this week were very concerned about, you know, being newly sober themselves, sometimes days, sometimes, you know, months, that they would be come into contact with people who were still using alcohol and drugs, and that it would be a pretty big temptation. So it's an interesting question, and we'll see where Catholic Services takes that.
Let's go to the phone with Jim Deruta is joining us, and Jim is with the New Bedford Standard Times. Hello, Jim.
Morning, Sean.
Jim, you have a couple stories today that in a way are related because they speak to a community, a town in these cases, that's creating legislation to kind of fight something that's bigger than the town itself.
Yeah, we have like varying degrees of David and Goliath battles going on in Dartmouth, Marion, and Acushnet. In Dartmouth this week, the Bristol County Superior Court had recently ruled that a plan from 2012 to cap off a 23-acre landfill, it supported the Conservation Commission in denying the permit to do that. They were going to bring in like 1.3 or 1.4 million tons of contaminated but not hazardous construction demolition debris to cap off this 23-acre landfill. And the town was concerned it's situated on aquifer, and they thought that, okay, we can't find any indication that it's leaking. This landfill is leaking contaminants into our groundwater now. If we put a, you know, 3 billion pounds on top of it, won't it squeeze it out like a lemon? So they got the court to agree with them. So now they're going to have to, if they're going to do anything to cap this off, it'll probably have to be a lot less intrusive, and they'll have to come with a whole different plan.
And then the
Marion. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the town of Marion. This was really interesting to me because they're setting themselves up for a battle with Big Tobacco.
Big Tobacco, yeah. Talk about a Goliath, right? They recently passed some laws, the Board of Health there, to ban like these synthetic marijuana and other synthetic stimulants that people buy in convenience stores and things like that. But now they want to ban menthol tobacco under the provision that prohibits the marketing of flavored tobaccos. So the federal regulation provides a sort of exemption for menthol, but Marion wants to push it. They've already heard from the Massachusetts Association of Health Boards that they would have free legal services from a public health advocacy institute if they were to be sued by Big Tobacco.
Wow, because
so they're thinking of going forward with it.
And health boards, you say it's the Association of Health Boards for the Massachusetts?
Mass Association of Health Boards, yeah.
So they're probably thinking this could be a domino that could continue to fall in other communities.
Right, and of course, but wasn't Massachusetts one of the big winners in the anti-tobacco settlement?
That's right.
One of the leads in that. And then, of course, in Acushnet, we've talked a little bit before about these massive LNG tanks that they want to build, then proposed, that would increase the size of the tanks that are there by some 13-fold. And the neighborhood groups have tried to get the town to support them with a negative opinion to have it be the official record of the town, but that would really tie the town's hands. That they really don't have the ability to just say, we don't like it, so you can't bring it here. It just won't work that way. But what the town has done is, like most significantly, they adopted a bylaw last month that really upgrades the requirements that they put on the proponents as far as dealing with the impacts, which means fire equipment, training, and staffing, not just in Acushnet, but in the surrounding towns that deal with Acushnet for mutual aid and their fire protection. Hmm. They've also been lobbying pretty hard to apply some modern fire protection standards, and they have gotten some traction.
Well, I guess we'll be following all three of these stories. Jim Deruta of the New Bedford Standard Times. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Sean.
It's always nice when there's a theme that connects the stories we're discussing, right?
There is, and I like it when the theme happens to be local government.
That's right. Thank you, Jim. Let's stay on the phone with Ann Wood, who's joining us from the Provincetown Banner. Hello, Ann.
Hey, how are you, Sean?
I'm doing well. I've actually been out to that Highland Center in North Truro, which is kind of a crazy place. It's got all these abandoned buildings. Of course, they have the music up there in one area as well. So what's happening? They've talked about tearing some of this down over the years, right?
Yeah, it makes me really sad. So the North Truro Air Force Station was built after the Russians tested their first atomic bomb in 1951 as a radar listening station and monitor for Soviet bombers. And in it, there are houses and neighborhoods. There's There are parks, there are movie theaters, bowling alleys, a bar, barracks, all sorts of things. And it's on the end of this big cliff that looks down over the water, and it's really beautiful. But since it was decommissioned in 1994, it's gone, you know, it's just sort of been weathered. So now it looks like something out of Cormac McCarthy's The Road. It's completely an apocalyptic-looking scene with sort of houses that are falling into disrepair and grass coming up through the concrete and all of that. But it's a really neat scene. And the seashore, which owns it, which got it after it was decommissioned, about 110 acres of it, has wanted to dismantle it for a long time. So we just received word from Cape Cod National Seashore Superintendent George Price that at the end of this month, 8 structures will be demolished, and it's going to cost about $1.2 million because of all the hazmat remediation costs. There's a lot of asbestos. Apparently, the outsides of the building, the shingles, were made of asbestos. Mm. And so they're going to get rid of about 8 buildings, 2 former barracks, a central heating power plant, and some ranch houses in an old neighborhood.
And any idea about the future of that area?
Well, I think they just planned to take it down little by little, but they were originally going to have it as an arts and science center, which it is. Payment, as you were saying, there's a Payment Performing Arts Center tent that has tons of really cool music all summer long. And also there's an atmospheric research lab and national park facilities in there. So I think that'll stay, but there's no plans to build anything. The Cape Cod National Seashore's purview is to basically let nature take its course. So I assume that as soon as they get all of these buildings down, they're just going to let nature happen.
Interesting.
But it's kind of sad because it's a really cool, cool spot. I mean, it's so neat. There's nothing else in the world. It's kind of like, especially this time of year, really good to go into because it's pretty creepy walking around in this sort of abandoned town.
I agree. And it's so otherworldly because you don't expect something like that on Cape Cod.
It really is, and especially when you look over the cliff and you can see the water there. And I remember going there in the 80s and hanging around with some family friends, and there was a rope that was dropped from, like, the dunes that you would kind of go down on the rope and come back up to the beach on the rope, which they would never allow now on the dunes. Now it's a park service area, but it's really just sort of the most amazing place. So anybody who wants to go see it as it is should probably go soon, although you're not supposed to go in any of the houses, but you can kind of walk around the neighborhoods.
All right. Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner. Thank you, Ann.
Hey, thanks. Take care.
You too. Let's take a quick break. Gwen Friss is here from the Cape Cod Times. Nelson Siegelman will join us from the Martha's Vineyard Times. And welcome back to The Point. This is the weekly news roundup here on The Point and WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran. Gwen Friss is here from the Cape Cod Times. Gwen, a report that we're reading about this week that really speaks to some of the changing demographics in our area. We've been talking about this for years. We know that it's happening, and we expect it to continue as young people continue to leave this area, including young families.
This is a report that's done every 3 years by Cape Cod Hospital and Falmouth Hospital and their parent company, Cape Cod Healthcare. And you're right, the director of community benefits for Cape Cod Healthcare said that there were no great surprises, but, you know, there's a continued awareness that there's a greater need for consumption of healthcare services. That's from Lisa Guyon, the director of community benefits. One thing, though, that did strike me was how quickly this is happening. If you look at the numbers, there's a breakout with some of the numbers I was just going to tell you about. You know, Barnstable County is expected to lose 13% of its overall population between 2010 and 2035. And that's mainly due to the outflow of young people from the region and deaths continuing to outnumber births. And also, we have nearly 26% of the Cape's year-round population is over age 65, and that 26% is compared to a statewide average of 14% and a national of 13%. So we are, you know, literally twice the national average for people over 65 as part of our population. So I won't read all the numbers, but it was pretty striking that was true. And I guess in the long run, you're looking at that continued care for health for health need for health care, especially in things like Alzheimer's services and heart, you know, cardiac services, things that people need as they age.
Absolutely. We've done a lot of reporting on this, and it's interesting talking to people who say, you know, in the fall, I don't see any children in the neighborhood anymore. And they speak of the vitality of their neighborhoods without younger people. Others have called me and said, you know, so what? If the younger people need to leave, that's fine. That's their choice. It's not really, it doesn't really affect me that much. But what keeps getting pointed out is it does. It affects you. It affects all of us in terms of who's here to provide services, what those services may cost. And I think we even see it when you go into a restaurant now. If it's packed, the restaurant's having trouble finding, you know, servers, having trouble finding people to work in the kitchen. And so everything's going up in cost as you try to attract more workers.
Everything, you know, from the availability of a, you know, workers pool to your tax rate, mm-hmm. you know, to not have a, this is not opinion, this is fact, to not have a residential base that is a mixed one makes it harder and more expensive for a community to continue to thrive. So
go talk to a superintendent or a fire chief or a police chief and find out what it's like trying to recruit new people to come here and work. They have to get paid more. Housing is more expensive. It's an issue that's not going away, and there's a lot of reporting around it.
Yeah, and as far as the not the health part of it, but the residential part of it, I saw recently posted on one of the internet boards for the Cape. It said that there are 12 people to date on the Cape. It's a problem from a social point of view too. People just aren't here to, you know, to get to know each other, to start raising families here.
That's true. Big anniversary coming up, 400th anniversary of the Pilgrim Landing. We've heard on this show before a little bit of a little go between Provincetown and Plymouth, but this story this week is about the place where we think that the pilgrims kind of landed out on the Outer Cape when they first arrived.
I think the words first set foot up every now and then. But what we're talking about is the Pilgrims' first landing park in Provincetown. And that park is at the Traffic Rotary at the west end of Commercial Street. And the issue here is that the town had been keeping up the park and the surrounding roads, but the town is looking to have, you know, their spruce up of the area has stalled, and it's looking, you know, a little beat up. The trees are overgrown and it's just not looking cared for, you mm-hmm. know. So what the town is looking for is to enter into an agreement with the state where the state will do some of the work and the town will do the rest. And basically, I think we're talking about the expression the town will take care of the pavement up. So that includes, you know, mowing and landscaping and all that kind of thing. And then in the winter, plowing the roads around. But the state will do the infrastructure, like, you know, rebuilding the roads and paving and that kind of thing. So from the pavement down. And that's what's
like
expected to happen.
Things had gotten a little weird with red tape, and it sounded like whenever the town wanted to go in to do a little work, they had to fill out forms, and it wasn't always the most efficient way to maintain this pretty significant historic area.
Yeah, and that happened just recently. I think that was within the past year or two that this requirement for the extra paperwork, and I think Provincetown was saying, hey, we're doing the work, you know.
We're going in to cut the trees. Maybe we don't need to fill out thousands of forms. All right, let's go to Nelson Siegelman, who's joining us from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hello, Nelson.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. It was a really exciting event last year when Gayhead Light was moved. I saw the Nova documentary special on that as well. It was really spectacular. Now you have a story in the Times this week about the actual lighthouse itself and the shape that it's in.
Yes, and I should agree with you. That Nova lighthouse special, Operation Lighthouse Rescue, was really well done. And the most interesting part for me was looking at the graphics, the way they were able to break down the move piece by piece was quite interesting. Well, now that they've moved it back from the edge of the eroding cliff, the problem is it's basically an old house that wasn't well maintained, and there are a number of problems. So the company that moved the lighthouse back, International Chimney Corp, also did a top-to-bottom assessment of what was needed, and they've provided a 10-page report to the town about immediate repairs and also more long-term repairs. And I think in general it breaks down to just the brick, a lot of the mortars deteriorated, so they have to go back in there, and they want to do everything. So it's historically correct as well. They've gone to all this trouble to move the lighthouse. It was almost a $3.5 million move, so they want to make sure everything still looks the same once they've gone back in there.
So is that definitely going to happen now? Is the money in place, or they're seeking it?
No, the money is not in place. Right. So the Lighthouse Committee says that they're going to be looking for state and federal grants. Mm. And one of the things I've learned over this long process is that by identifying specific goals, they have a better chance of getting grants for this. And this is where that report will be very helpful, so they can really just point to specific projects. For example, there are some cracks in the windows around the lighthouse that have to be repaired, and just metal work that has to be done. And the interesting thing is the company recommended a five-year cycle of inspections, and they said that even once the lighthouse restoration is complete, you need to then start planning for just a continuing cycle of upkeep and maintenance.
Okay, makes sense. Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you, Nelson.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Gwen Friss from the Cape Cod Times here. There's going to be a recovery effort for some ocean debris, primarily fishing equipment. And so there's, I think, some grant money in place for that. That's kind of an important thing, because that wayward gear can cause a lot of problems for active fishermen.
It can, and also for for the environment.
Sure.
And we're always hearing about whales becoming entangled. And
it's almost all plastic, too, these days.
And that kind of thing. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. I'll do this story, I promise, but when we talk about, marine life, I have to tell you that our video guy, Jason, visited the Mystic Aquarium to visit the pregnant manatee yesterday. Oh, such a cute video. Got to check that one out.
And what are we calling the manatee now? Washburn? Washburn.
Yes, Washburn, because it was netted off of Washburn Island. And at the time, nobody knew that it was a she and she was pregnant. So
I think they were saying it was a
really,
he.
Yeah. Well, miracle of life here. And the only thing I will tell you is that she prefers romaine lettuce. So check out that video.
Oh,
it's just really
very
cute.
Interesting. Okay.
But let's get back to work here. And it's a 15-month project with a $95,000 grant that's coming through the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Sorry, I did that badly. But it's part of their marine debris program, and it allows them to hire commercial fishermen, lobstermen in particular, to go out and pick up lost equipment. And that equipment can range from things that came off of nets from trawlers, lobster traps that have become unmoored, recreational fishing. There's a wide range. This is not new, and I was really impressed at how much they've already gotten. More than 16 tons have been taken out of the waters in this area, and including 660 lobster traps. Now, what happens to them is they're either returned to the owners or they're recycled at a trash to energy plant, mm-hmm. depending on what kind of shape they're in.
Yeah, it's interesting how they do it. They use sonar and big hooks to kind of just hook the stuff and pull it right up.
Yeah, I had a chance to go out on one of those boats once, and it is really interesting.
Let's start with this one. Barnstable has a ban on plastic bags that has gone into effect after there was kind of a waiting period to get people ready for this. There's still some folks, I guess, who are exempt at this time. But so No more paper or plastic when you go to the supermarket.
That's right. And this sort of ties in because these plastic bags are really thin ones that kind of fly away and you see them out there dancing on the street.
Well, they break.
Yeah. There's that too. But you know, this is kind of the land version of some of the plastics that are a problem for marine life as well as for they don't biodegrade. They may break on you, Sean, but they're not breaking down when you try to recycle them. So the new rule says that they have to be, any kind of plastic bag has to be at least 3 millimeters thick. And so 3/1000ths of an inch. And to give you a picture of what that is, if you have gone to the grocery store and they say, do you want to buy a 10-cent bag? That's the new thickness that is being looked for. And they have them, I noticed, here in Falmouth, they're selling them at some of the convenience stores and that kind of thing.
Yeah, Falmouth was one of the first towns.
So that, I ran into one this morning. But there are a few exemptions, as you mentioned. Things that are trash bags that are sold in packages are not included in this. And also bags that are used to for dry cleaning or to wrap flowers. So there are a few exemptions. But that sort of white bag you see every place, you know, that thin white bag that you can almost see through, those are the ones that you'll no longer have as of Monday. So you might want to think about bringing a cloth bag or a heavier bag. I know I keep them in the car and forget them every time. I can't tell you how many times I've come back out to the car.
I think we've all had that experience. Let's skip ahead to this young man from Falmouth Academy who really made his school and I'm sure his family proud at the Google Science Fair. I think it was just, maybe it might have been just last week.
Last week he came out on top. And when we often say to refer to things, it's not rocket science. This is rocket science.
Right.
Charlie Fenske, I hope I'm saying that right, has been fascinated with rockets since he was a little kid and made his first one with a paper towel roll. And he just kept getting better at it. And he's a junior at Falmouth Academy. He qualified for the Google Science Fair, being named as one of the 100 finalists. And then in August, he was named as one of the 16 finalists. And he and his mom went to Google to the headquarters and actually for a ceremony out there. And he came out on top. So I don't know about you, but I think every time I look at the Google Doodle now, I'll be thinking about Charlie and his rocket.
And it's a rocket guidance system, I think, that he was working on.
It is a rocket guidance system that won him the Google Prize. And I think he will continue to work on refining that because he has plans to go to Stanford University, hopefully, and will continue his aerospace studies there.
He's a junior, I think.
He's a junior, so that's why I say hopefully. I don't think he has it. An admission yet. You know, it's too soon.
they'd be foolish not to get this guy into Stanford or wherever. That's a very nice story. Actually, we did, before he left, we heard that he was going over to Google. So we had a conversation with him on Morning Edition. Folks, if they want to hear directly from Charlie, they can go to our website and listen to Catherine Iden speak with him about his science and his winning ways. I think he was 7 years old when he won his first science fair.
He was, and I will be one of the folks looking that up, Sean, because that would be lovely.
Okay. Well, Gwen Friss from the Cape Cod Times, I want to thank you for coming in and talking about the news of the week. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks for having us.
Oh, of course. And Sarah Brown joined us from the Martha's Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim DeRuda from the New Bedford Standard Times, and we spoke with Ann Wood from the Provincetown Banner and Nelson Siegelman from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Brian Morris from WCAI came in to talk about that wind cube. I'm Sean Corcoran. I want to thank you for listening.